You are now listening to the On Cue Performance Therapy Podcast, where the worlds of sports medicine and performance collide. My name is Mike Quintons. I'm a physical therapist with an entrepreneurial mindset that specializes in treating orthopedic and sports injuries. I'm bringing on the brightest and sharpest in the field of sports medicine to share their best practices and explore the gap where medicine meets performance. What's up, Performance Therapy Nation? This is Mike Quintons, your host of the On Cue Performance Therapy Podcast. Today, I'll be joined by strength conditioning coach Rob Rubina for all of season 4 and 5. Our special guest today is Kat Hammer. Kat Hammer is here from the University of Pennsylvania and has her own business, and we're stoked to get into everything from she's a dietitian, so we're talking about performance, diet, sleep, across the gamut, really. So quick bio on Kat. Since starting at University of Penn in 2020, Kat has overseen the nutritional strategies and approaches for Penn's intercollegiate teams, meeting individually with student athletes, as well as providing team and small group presentations. She also serves on multiple interdisciplinary committees with other members of Penn Sports Performance Unit to better serve the division's nearly 1,000 student athletes. The Philadelphia native is also the owner of Hammer Fuel Sports Nutrition, a virtual sports nutrition counseling and consulting business for middle school, high school, collegiate and professional athletes. She is also a consultant with Ascent Athlete, formerly Maple Zone Sports Institute, and began her career as the sports nutrition assistant with the Bradentown Marauders, the high A affiliate of the Pittsburgh Pirates. Hammer earned her bachelor's degree in nutrition and dietetics from Westchester University in 2018, where she was a 3-time all-region and 2-time all-conference softball player for the Golden Rams. She received a master's degree in exercise and nutrition science from the University of Tampa in 2019. That's quite the bio. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
I'm stoked. But so Rob, share with us how you know Kat. And
well, I think we first started as I was your strength coach. You were an athlete. Go Rams.
Go Rams.
Right. Yeah. You're catcher, right? Catcher.
Yep.
And we trained for what, a couple years, 2-3 years together?
Yeah. I started as a sophomore and trained all the way
sophomore,
through.
Sophomore. Yep. Then you went on and interned with me.
Mm-hmm. Became an intern. Yep.
Learned a thing or two.
And, I learned a lot. I was only an intern for like a month.
Yeah. December, right? Yeah. I remember now. Yeah. And then we worked together and kept a good relationship. And to see Kat grow into that bio you just read is awesome.
Yeah. So Rob walks over to me today at some point and he's like, so she's done this and she's done that. And then I asked you how old you were and I'm like, hold on, wait, how did you manage to do all that? So I love your passion and vulnerability in terms of putting yourself in different situations. And I literally just met you 15 minutes ago. So Kat, share with our listeners, how do you get to that point? Like psychologically, mentally, dive into that a little bit. How did you get here? And
yeah, so I've always been someone who is very, very driven and I'm always trying to figure out how do I get like one step ahead. So like people my age, I want to be one step ahead of that. And when I first learned about sports nutrition being a field, one of my mentors really kind of gave me a really good understanding of you have to do a lot of volunteer work and you have to just get your feet wet. It's not going to be fun, but you just have to do it. So I kind of took that and ran with it. So that's why I didn't even have to intern with Rob, but I was like, that's going to be helpful because I know I want to do a master's program that's also incorporating exercise or kinesiology or something like that. And I just thought that would give me like a little bit of a one up. And then just kind of getting through my master's program, I was fortunately able to get a job with the Pittsburgh Pirates. And like I was like not human during that time. I was in my master's program and working like at least 60 hours a week. It was just wild. But I was able to gain such an immense experience in such a short period of time. And that's kind of, I think, a blessing and a curse for me as I try to like just jam pack my life, but I'm gaining so much experience in a short period of time, but also like just trying to make sure that I'm creating boundaries and stuff like that has become very, very important because I can very easily get to one side where I'm just going and I never want to get to that point again where I'm like not human.
Once you've crammed, I can attest to that. Once you've gotten used to cramming things in and getting them done one way or another, it can kind of become a habit, right? So how do you keep that in track?
Yeah. Honestly, like I plan out my week and I have to make sure like one of the biggest things is that, so I'm very into working out and that has been my thing where if I find that I can't work out that day, I have not planned appropriately. Like I'm taking on too much. Like working out is something that's not just another thing. That's something that's like a release for me. So if I'm not giving myself the ability to do that, then I've gone too far. So that has been a good kind of like thing to help me navigate not doing too much, not going over the top.
So let's get into like weekly prep a little bit. So like, that's a great transition. And I kind of want to dive into that. That's your barometer for, all right, I'm pushing too hard, or I'm doing too much, or I haven't planned, taking the time to plan appropriately if you're not getting a workout in. Is there any recommendations or anything that you have for athletes that in terms of planning their diet for the week? Right. And how do you implement that with what you do on a day to day?
Absolutely. So the way that I kind of look at it, like if you think about, okay, if you use Outlook or you use Google or whatever it is, and you look at your schedule for the day and you have like these blocks of appointments that are put in there, you're going to have these spaces, right, that are empty. Hopefully most people have at least some spaces in there. And when I'm like thinking about just diet alone, if you have a space there, that's probably a good opportunity to eat. So using that to kind of structure your day, structure your eating, and then kind of translating that, like structuring your week as well. So like, what do you have going on and what are opportunities that you can take to either fuel yourself or to do something that's going to be, you get your mind off of other things and just kind of move forward that way. And one thing that I used to do was like look at my week as a whole and be like, okay, so I have to accomplish all of these things throughout the week. And that became so incredibly overwhelming, where now I'm like just kind of going maybe one or two days at a time and just trying to do it that way. It's a little less just daunting.
So in the time you've been doing this, you're at the University of Pennsylvania, which, talking high IQ student athletes, but high achievers, type A for the most part, I would imagine, maybe even some procrastinators mixed in there in terms of personality. What's your message to them when you're dealing with these types of conversations, like high angst, high stress, high performance expectations across athletically and academically?
Yeah, this is something that I definitely learned in nutrition early on, but like being at Penn has like really taught me this. When you are working with a large variety of people, it's not one size fits all. So with some athletes, they want to have their entire week planned out as they go. And some athletes like can't even think about what's happening 3 hours from now. So you have to just think about the individual, meet them where they're at, understand their background, understand all of their needs, and kind of move through it that way. And also it's like so tough. I'm sure you guys see it too. When you have your lived experience, you like almost translate it to everyone else. And that's not helpful for everyone else. It's going to be helpful for some people. Like that example I use, looking at like a Google calendar, that's how I think about it in my mind. But for some athletes, they don't want to be that structured, or being that structured actually like could enhance some maybe like disordered eating tendencies or things like that. So you really have to understand the athlete or understand the individual. I think so many times in healthcare or health and science, we just kind of like cycle through people, right? Like think about like a doctor's office. They see so many people throughout the course of the day, and the messaging can just become like distorted, right? Or muddled, or whatever you want to say. You really do have to take the time to like understand that individual and go from there.
What's the average day look like for Cat Hammer?
Yeah, so depends on the day, but a majority of my days at Penn, I'm seeing athletes pretty much all day long. So just back to back to back to back. There's usually an athlete waiting outside of my office when one is leaving. So you have to figure out how to be present. And I think one of the ways that it's helpful, it's kind of hurtful and helpful at the same time, is I'm seeing such a huge variety of athletes. So I could be working with a football player who's looking to gain weight. I could be working with a wrestler who's trying to make weight. You can be working with a cross-country runner who's really struggling with disordered eating or eating disorders. So like before each appointment, you have to like relook at your notes and just center yourself again and be like, okay, what does my conversation look like right now? How does my mood or energy kind of change going into this next appointment to meet both the situation and also meet the individual where they're at? Maybe not across the board, but maybe just that day, especially if you're struggling with like such sensitive cases, you do have to kind of figure out how to navigate it just in that moment in that day. So I need to take notes. I don't know how people work without taking notes. If I don't write it down, it's not happening. So
I don't take notes, Scott.
That's crazy. You must be a genius.
He really does.
I don't take notes.
I don't know how you do that.
I don't know how he does it either. I don't know if I've ever seen Rob write anything down.
No, I don't really. I'm not a big note guy. That's why, like, when I teach, I don't even have PowerPoints.
He's just so smart.
Just imagine being a student in that class.
Top of the head, just like that.
Mr. Rabina, can I... Can we have anything to study from? He's like, wait, you didn't memorize all that?
But yeah, most of my day is seeing athletes. We also have a bod pod machine at Penn, so I'm doing a lot of body composition, and then also doing a ton of team education, team talk. So again, this could be so many different things. It could be working with the wrestlers on their post weigh-in approach. It could be working with the soccer team on, okay, they have a stretch of games, like maybe like three in a week or something. How do we really focus on recovery that week? Or a huge variety of things. And then also just consulting for all the teams there. So what they're going to be eating while they're on the road, what are they stocking in their fueling stations in their locker rooms, or just kind of helping out with, okay, they see an athlete struggling. How do we get them to come see me without feeling like we're attacking them, or how are we just giving them the best care?
I was interested in that, Kat. Like, do you feel like athletes prefer more of like a group session, more one-on-one? Do you do like small group, like positions? Like, I guess it depends on the athlete if they're like going through something specific, but if it's just more general nutrition training, how do you go about handling that and which one do you prefer?
It depends on the individual, depends on the group, depends on the situation. And unfortunately, that's how so many things in nutrition are, super individualized. So like some athletes, if you know, you have four guys on the soccer team are all interested in creatine supplementation. Like, you guys can all come in for a meeting. Let's go over that. Maybe that's not a huge team meeting and it's just individualized meetings or like small group, or like maybe you have an individual who's just really struggling with their schedule. So that would be more of a one-on-one meeting. But then maybe you have a team who the coach kind of hears that they're all struggling eating before morning practice. Well, that could be a whole team talk. So it just depends. And again, just have to be sensitive to the situation.
And your one-on-ones, how much of that's confidential?
Yeah, so this is tough in my position because nutrition and dietetics, it is a confidential field, but also when you're working with like performance, then the lines kind of get blurred. So you really have to be attentive to what information is sensitive and what information. I'm not usually sharing information with coaches from specific meetings. I might say that they're doing well or they're not doing well and we need additional support. But some of the things I definitely have to share with the athletic trainers and maybe even the strength coaches to let them know like, hey, they're not doing well right now. I think we should talk about scaling back their exercise or something, or collaborating with team docs and stuff like that. So there's basically like two parts of what I do. It's like, I would say 50% clinical and then 50% sports performance. So it's kind of hard to navigate sometimes, but the more I'm in it, the more I'm kind of understanding how to do that.
Yeah. The how is tough, right? And then you get follow-up questions and how do you navigate that, right? And making sure there's boundaries, right? I would think.
Absolutely. And like, coaches want the best for their players. Like, I've never met a coach that doesn't want the best for their players. When I was a college athlete, it's hard. Sometimes your coach can be so tough on you that you're like, they don't have my best interest in mind, but they absolutely do. So like when coaches will ask me, hey, how's this athlete doing? And I say, they're doing great and they're progressing. They'll ask like, well, what are they doing? And that's when it becomes kind of touchy. It's like, well, I really can't tell you what they're doing or the specific conversation, but I can just give you like, just like the vibe of the conversation or something along those lines.
So let's break it down. Like, let's get into some of the nitty gritty with this, because this has been so far, like, I love what you do, love where you're coming from and what your goals are and how you have one-on-one meetings like all day. That's awesome. The director of dietitian at Penn, that you're that involved, not just a figurehead, right? So what goes into putting together a dietary plan, right? Or a nutritional plan?
Yeah. So I think when a lot of people hear that, they immediately just think meal plan, and that's not what everybody needs. So I'll have athletes that come in and they're like, hey, I want to supplement with magnesium and ashwagandha and all of these like kind of random things. And then I'm like, oh, you always go to, okay, we'll circle back to that. Let's look at a little bit of background first and let's look at what you're doing right now with nutrition. And so many times athletes will be like, yeah, I want to supplement with all these random things. And then they're eating twice a day. So it's like, we need to back up 10 steps. We need to make sure your intake is good first, and then we can progress to some supplements, because their supplements are really not going to have as much effect if you're not eating breakfast, right? So usually when they can buy into that, they're going to see the best results, versus if they're just like, oh, she's just told me to eat more, but I want to take these supplements. They might not come back for another appointment, which is hard to do, and definitely hard to do when you're working with a like large population. But yeah, I'm always bringing it back to diet. I don't even like want to look at supplements in most cases until we really have had a good go at making sure your diet looks pretty good.
Okay. So, all right. So that's supplements and that conversation with diet. Someone who is average basketball player, I don't know, 6'4", 210 pounds, 215 pounds, something like that. Like, how many calories should they have a day? And then how do you calculate, how do you factor in their caloric usage during the day, during the week? And if you want to make it more general, that's fine.
No, that's fine. So for maybe one of the college basketball players I would be working with, or in calorie expenditures, I wouldn't say it's any lower than 3,000 calories a day, right? It's definitely going to be that or way more. And there's some athletes I'm working with who are over 5,000 calories a day.
Yeah, your endurance athletes, right? I would imagine.
Endurance like athletes, swimmers, or linemen on the football team. Yeah, okay. Stuff like that. So it becomes very, very high. And we just have to work through like, how do we translate that to food? Because it's one thing to say you're burning this many calories, but like, how do we translate that to food?
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, and do you reference like the cafeteria? Like, how do you figure this all out? Because there's so many variables.
Yeah. So again, it comes back to like having an understanding of like where they're at. Are they a freshman and sophomore living on campus? Are they a junior, senior living off campus? And then I have a close connection with the campus dietitians who have helped me really understand what's offered at the dining halls. And we pull up the menus from the dining halls. Or like I'll be teaching some athletes like how to make a marinade for chicken or something. So it's really like, so
really, you did like part psychologist, part cook, like chef, like it's a lot,
which is like kind of fun because like no appointment is the same. That would be so boring. So like every time an athlete comes in, it's just like, you never know what you're going to get and you never know what, where they're going to be at that day. Right. When you're working with like really high performers, some days they're having a great day and some days they are so stressed with the stuff's going on. And like, they don't even need to talk about nutrition. Some days they just like need to come in and talk. So
yeah, Kat, I think that's a great segue into like, talk about, I guess, like the difference between like a registered dietitian and like, you see this all the time with like fitness professionals, like, yeah, I'm a nutritionist. It's like, well, what's that? You know, so just talking about the differences between the two. And I think the one of the big things that hopefully you bring up is like the counseling component.
So if you ever want to make a dietitian mad, you can call them a nutritionist. You can call them a nutritionalist. You can call them dietary. You can call them anything but a dietitian and it's going to make them really mad. So by law, at least in Pennsylvania, dietitians own the term nutritionist. So in Pennsylvania, if you call yourself a nutritionist and you don't have a registered dietitian certification, you could technically get in trouble.
So they're interchangeable, but in terms of a title, you don't offend a dietitian by calling them a nutritionist, but they do own the term nutritionist.
Correct. And that's like state to state. So like some states you have to be certified as a dietitian to like also own that term nutritionist as well. And some states it's totally fine to call yourself a nutritionist and you would not get in trouble for it. But just to be a nutritionist, you could call yourself a nutritionist just because you have some knowledge of nutrition, right? You don't really have to have any credentials, any proven credentials to be able to do that. So that's actually really important for people to know. There's so many like health coaches out there who I'm sure most of them have everybody's best interest at mind, but at the end of the day, they don't have the understanding of, okay, medical nutrition therapy. So anytime you're working with somebody and they start talking about any type of health condition, if you're a health coach, you need to just back up and say, I need to refer you to someone else, right? So a dietitian can work with those people with medical nutrition therapy. So that would be like any GI disorder. So colitis, Crohn's, IBS, anything like that, diabetes, kidney disease. So nutritionists can really get in a lot of trouble if they're working with people who have those conditions. So yes, very important to know that dietitians kind of own all of that and have a ton of experience. So they have to have an undergraduate degree. Now they have to have a master's degree and you have to complete a dietetic internship, which is 1200 hours of supervised practice in very specific dietetic realms.
So when's it going to be a doctorate degree?
Not anytime soon.
Those are extensive hours. Like that's a lot.
Yeah.
You know, PT school is like now obviously doctorate degree and it's like 7 years and it's like a lot of hours and you guys are crawling towards that. And you have autonomy. Like you can treat someone off the street.
Yeah.
Right.
It depends on the setting, right? So like we have like what's called like privileges. Like in a hospital, you only have certain privileges and it depends on the state, depends on the circumstance and all of those things. And then, yeah, it just depends on the setting. But we definitely are moving in a direction that I think is good, requires a lot more education. But at the same time, there's still like this lack of knowledge of what's the difference between a dietitian and a nutritionist. And people are still going to the nutritionist thinking that they can help. And again, I want to hope or I want to think that they have the best interest in mind, but they're charging these like ridiculous rates. Like I heard of like $500 for 30 minutes and they don't even have these like actual credentials. So a lot of people are getting ripped off, unfortunately.
So I think that's important for our listeners to really, really grasp is, are you seeing the appropriate medical professional?
Yeah.
You know, especially for your dollar, it's certainly relevant.
So don't just follow nutrition advice from someone who looks jacked.
Yeah.
Okay.
Just to like go off of that really quick, all of this stuff on TikTok with like what I eat in a day is just crazy. People are just posting random things and most of them aren't even actually eating that in a day, or they're eating more than that, or they have other things going on because they're not eating enough, but they're showing their abs. It's just crazy. There's so much out there.
It's bad, especially in fitness. Like I've seen lots of fitness coaches. Like, I don't know, like to my knowledge, I don't think fitness coaches are technically allowed to give meal plans. Is that correct?
That's correct. Yeah. You can't, if you're a dietitian, you can give a meal plan. If you're a nutritionist, you're like not supposed to term it as a meal plan.
Right.
If somebody asks you, what are good sources of protein or like how many calories should I be eating in a day? There's calorie calculators online. You can do that. But to give them a structured thing, that's actually
eat this for breakfast, eat this for lunch, have this for a snack. Yeah. Okay. You can't do that. Yeah. And it's not, fitness professionals aren't trained in that.
No.
To be honest, they're not, and they shouldn't be doing that, and feel like that's a huge no-no in my book.
I mean, it seems like it's harmless to do that, like tell somebody what to eat in a day, but at the same time, when you don't have the necessary background information on that individual, if we're telling them to do something and they have other stuff going on that you're unaware of, like that actually can be harmful. So we need to have the right level of knowledge to be able to do those things.
I mean, like taking things into account, like medication.
Exactly.
What medication you're having, maybe like amphetamines or whatever else, maybe the opposite. Maybe it's, you know, beta blockers, whatever, you know, but like all depends. But like obviously all of these things, you know, how much caffeine, what's your caffeine intake, right?
Yeah.
Like that can maybe be associated with or without calories at times. So
yeah. Right? And I'm sure we'll get into this, but like just nutritionists or health coaches are recommending supplements, and most of the supplements out there are not regulated. So they're recommending these wild things with crazy names, and they can actually be extremely, extremely harmful.
All right. That's a teaser, because I do have like two other quick questions, and then I definitely want to dive into supplements. How are you tracking what your athletes are doing in terms of like performance in a day? Whether it was like, hey, it rained, so we had to practice inside, so we obviously wasn't much conditioning or whatever. So how do you track that in a day? Is that important to track in a day?
Yeah, that's a good question. I know you kind of referenced this earlier as well. So when I'm looking at an athlete, like a collegiate athlete who is training a majority of the week, so they're training hard 5 days a week, and maybe on day six is, you know, a lighter, just kind of like recovery activation type thing. And then maybe they have like one full rest day. What I like to do, and not everybody does this, but what I like to do is kind of average it out throughout the course of the week. So throughout the week, maybe we're shooting for 4,000 calories, knowing that some days you're going to be burning 4,500 calories and some days you're going to be burning 3,000 calories. But when you have super busy individuals, to try to tell them, okay, on Monday, when you're training hard, you're going to eat 4,500 calories. On Tuesday, you're going to eat 4,300 calories. On Wednesday, it just gets so crazy and so cumbersome. Most of them, again, are not eating breakfast. So like, how do we just simplify it? So again, I'm just giving them really the average throughout the course of the week. If they have some days where maybe they're going into winter training like now, and they're only going to be training hard 3 days a week, maybe we can vary it a little bit at that point. But for the most part, if you're training a majority of the week, let's just average it to keep it simple and keep your intake relatively the same throughout the course of the week. And maybe the exception is on light training days or rest days, we're just decreasing the amount of carbohydrates we're consuming. So just keep it really simple.
So that was kind of my next question in terms of carbohydrates or protein. How do you modify intake of those, like of the big ones, right? So your fats, your carbohydrates, your proteins, how do you modify that with activity, caloric expenditure?
Great question. So there's these really famous, well-known athletes plates out there. So there's like three plates that we draw from. The one that refers to the hardest training day has the most amount of carbohydrates, assuming that on hard training days, you're burning through the most carbs. So you want to replace the most carbs. On easy training days, our rest days, we're probably not burning through a ton of carbohydrates. So we just don't need to take in as many. So the main thing that I work with athletes on is throughout the course of the week, keeping protein intake relatively the same. Harder training days, increasing carbs. Lighter training days, decreasing carbs. Whenever you increase carbs, you can decrease the fruit and veggie you have in the meal. When you decrease carbs, you can increase the amount of fruit and veggie you have in a meal. So like, again, keeping it really simple. And you can get way more specific with certain athletes, but like, in my opinion, it takes like years to have a good understanding of what you should be doing to then get more specific than that. Like, I have very few athletes, even at like a very high collegiate Division I level, that are doing more than that or getting more specific than that. And I just don't think it's appropriate for most athletes to get too into the nitty gritty. Becomes so overwhelming.
They're student athletes, and we're talking about University of Pennsylvania. So I'm sure they don't have a ton of free time to be.
No, not at all.
Yeah. So any apps or any recommendations in terms of logging, tracking, journals, any tips for our listeners?
Yeah, I like food logs, and we don't even have to really get into specifics of total calories and things like that. I like somebody to just draw attention to what they're consuming. I think when you can look at over the course of the day, and you said, okay, so if we're tracking the meal, the time, and the foods or beverages that you're consuming, if you see that you have a gap of time, you have like 7 hours that you didn't eat, okay, well, that's really good to show us that we should put a snack in there, we should put another meal in there, something like that. And again, the more specific, the more time you're at this, maybe we can look at calories more specifically, but most athletes, I don't like to do that. But as far as like what apps are out there, like I know everybody knows about MyFitnessPal. that has a lot of flaws to it, definitely, because it's an open database, meaning that anybody can enter in information. A lot of things in there are not accurate. But at the same time, I think that it sometimes can have value, because if you have somebody who has never looked at calories before, right? And you're like, eat 2,500 calories. And they're like, what's a calorie? Well, if you track for like literally like 3 to 5 days and just get a little bit of knowledge on like when you eat a banana, it's mostly a carbohydrate. When you eat a piece of chicken, it's mostly protein. Like, I think that could be helpful for a very small period of time. But then there's other apps out there, and usually you have to pay for them. Like Carbon Diet Coach is a really good one, but you have to, it's a closed database, so everything is a little bit more accurate, but again, you have to pay for it. So I always like to start people off with just, how do we think about structuring our meals, timing of meals, and then give them information on, okay, pre-workout, high carb, post-workout, make sure we focus on protein and carb, things like that.
Okay. So you mentioned timing, pre-workout, post-workout. Tell me about, like, what do athletes do wrong at breakfast? What should they be doing? I want to hear the same thing for pre-workout and post-workout.
This is a fun question. I like this. So breakfast, a lot of people aren't eating breakfast. And the reason, I know everyone says like breakfast is the most important meal. I don't know if that's 100% true, but it's definitely has value, because you're coming off of an overnight fast. People don't like to think about that, right? So if the last time you eat is 8 p.m. and you don't eat breakfast, you might not be eating until noon. So you just came off of really, really long fast. And whenever you're coming off of a really long fast, your body goes into like a catabolic state where it's breaking down muscle, right? So if you're trying to build muscle, you're at a disadvantage now. Or if you get a breakfast in that's rich in protein and carbohydrates, it's going to help you with energy throughout the day, and the protein to help with the muscle recovery and repair. Like, you're just starting off the day in a much better spot. So a lot of people don't eat breakfast. And then when people do eat breakfast, a lot of times breakfast items are very rich in carbohydrates. People will just have like oatmeal and no protein with it. So like, can we add a Greek yogurt, or can we add a protein shake or some eggs or something like that? So those are the main things I see with breakfast. With pre-workout, especially with like high school athletes. So in my private practice, I work with a lot of those, and they always say, oh yeah, I just had a protein bar before practice. And people are like not understanding there's a difference between like a protein bar and a granola bar, right? Like a protein bar is like a Cliff Builders bar. And a granola bar is like a Nature Valley bar, or Cliff bar, or something like that. If you eat a protein bar right before you work out, that protein has a longer time it's going to take to break down. And protein doesn't, in most circumstances, give you readily available energy. We want a high carb bar right before we work out. So get a Cliff bar, get a Nature Valley bar, get some applesauce or banana or something like that. And then post-workout, a lot of people are just like, post-workout, they just go home and they're just like waiting for dinner to be ready. And it's like 2 hours later. But like post-workout, within like about an hour, it's really important to get something in. Your cells are way more receptive to taking in protein and carbohydrates. So really just maximizing what you just did in that workout. So getting something in relatively soon, super important. It's not the most important thing. The total course of the day is the most important thing. How does it flow? Are we getting enough throughout the course of the day? But post-workout, yeah, like let's get something in pretty soon after.
I love that. That's a great, great response. So I played football at Bloomsburg, and I got recruited to play fullback. I had to put on like some serious weight. I'm like 5'8" on a good day after 12 hours of sleep. So I was working out like hard, taking some creatine. And then after the workout, I would go to the cafeteria and I would load up on protein. I mean, like over 100 grams, not healthy amount of protein. What are some of the pitfalls to taking that kind of, you know, magnitude of protein?
So the biggest thing is like when you increase the amount of protein that you're intaking, you're decreasing the amount of carbs and fats and micronutrients that you can be taking in. So everyone always talks about, there was like a lot of research behind, you can only digest this amount of protein in this amount of time. And that's not, you can digest, if you give yourself 200 grams of protein, your body can digest it, or you'll throw it up, but you're going to digest it.
Right.
But you can't use all of that specifically for muscle growth and repair just in that one sitting. Right. You can use it for other things and you will digest it, but it's not efficient. It's not the way to do it. So you're taking away the amount of carbohydrates that you can take in. Carbohydrates are what are going to be your main source of energy. Fats are your long-lasting source of energy. But again, protein in almost all circumstances should not be providing readily available energy to your body. If it is, you're in a really compromised state and something's wrong with your body. So protein is just not, you don't want to focus on it to the degree that most people do. Most athletes are like, just load up on the protein.
Dude, I was getting like cups of cottage cheese.
Yeah.
That's where I was at. It wasn't good.
I mean, your arms look good.
For a little bit. But no, I mean, I think that it's important for
That was great, Kat. I mean,
thanks.
Yeah, no, I don't think I've shared that with too many people before, but like, I think that's something I know I went through and you're just trying to, like, you know what it's like. Like, you're trying to get as big or as strong as possible in a shorter period of time. You think you're doing everything right.
But I think that brought this up a little bit, Kat, but I feel like that brings up such a great point where I feel like athletes and maybe a little bit more in like the weight loss community where they avoid carbs. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm on a low carb diet, Rob. And I'm like, well, what? Like, how are you training and exercising when you're on a quote unquote low carb diet, right? And you know what that means when they're just not eating the pastas and the breads and that kind of stuff. And it's like, yeah, I'm just like doing low carb because like my friend did it and lost like 10 pounds. And this is the stuff that I hear. And I'm just like, oh, yeah, man.
Before senior week.
Yeah. Like, what do you like? I'm sure you have athletes that come to you and be like, I want to do low carb.
Yeah.
And as I'm cutting. Yeah. I want to do low carb. How do you have a conversation with somebody about that and like try to like educate athletes and active people that exercise on the importance of carbs and why people need to have them?
So it's way easier to have this conversation with an athlete versus somebody who's just kind of like working out just to be healthy. So when you're working with an athlete, what you can tell them, and it's just end of story once you tell them this, is if you're not getting in carbohydrates, you then have to rely on a backup source of fuel for energy, which would be fat. That's what your body's going to go to next. Fat takes a long time to break down. It can't provide high, quick sources of energy to your body. So if you're trying to do a sprint time over time, your body's not going to be efficient. It can't recover quickly. It can't give you energy quickly. So it's just not efficient to do it that way. So when you can explain that to an athlete, that makes a lot more sense. We're like, okay, when you're working with somebody in the general public who just wants to be healthy, well, they're probably not running sprints. They're probably not doing like super high intensity things, short bouts. So my argument there would be like, how do you feel throughout the course of the day? How are your energy levels? Most people, as soon as you take out carbohydrates, are going to feel low energy, probably around like 2 or 3 o'clock. They're going to feel tired throughout the course of the day. But if you add carbohydrates in and do it the right way, not just having 200 grams of carbs at lunch because your employees got like pizza and pasta and all this stuff, right? But if you do it the right way, it is going to help with energy stabilization throughout the course of the day.
You're killing it. Intermittent fasting. This is like the hot thing.
Everyone does this.
I mean, could you call sleeping 8-9 hours, right? That's intermittent fasting to an extent. But now we're talking like what a Dana White was on the other day. He's like, I just did 72 hours or whatever. Like maybe it was more than that. I don't know. But anything I try and Rob the same way, like kind of critique it a little bit. And okay, like what are the pitfalls of that? What are the pros, cons? Weigh it out. This is your field. So how can fasting be beneficial or not beneficial? Especially for, I'm curious about not only the physical performance, but the cognitive performance. Like we all have to be on mentally, right? Like, mm-hmm. And so do athletes, right? Especially at Penn. And they have to process information quickly and then react, right? So you have to be on more than just like physical performance. It's more than that. So share how intermittent fasting can impact those things.
Definitely. So I'm not an expert in longevity, but there is research showing that bouts of fasting could potentially help with longevity and just having the gut work properly, stuff like that. But that is not supported for just general population. Like you have to be at a certain level of health to be able to get those benefits. If you're just the general person, probably not beneficial. One of the things that I think may be beneficial with intermittent fasting for general population is if you have this eating window of 8 hours and you are doing a good job with your intake, you're having well-balanced meals, they're timed right, all of these good things, it could be a good goal setter where like, okay, at 6 p.m., I don't eat anymore for the night, right? It kind of like cuts you off. And I think that could be a positive, also can definitely be a negative because I know so many people who tell me intermittent fasting and they're just like crushing all of this food within their eating window. And that's not how you should do it at all. Also thinking about what we mentioned earlier with when you are coming off of an overnight fast, your body needs protein, it needs carbohydrates to kind of rebuild that muscle tissue and then also help with energy levels and stuff like that. So if you're having these like very structured eating windows, you're probably going to feel low energy. You're probably going to be in a catabolic state for a large period of the day. Anytime you're not eating, you're going to enter into a catabolic state once your body has processed most of the food. So again, if you're trying to put on muscle, which everybody should have that focus, this is a little side note, like we talk so much about losing weight, but we need to change the conversation to let's build muscle.
Preach.
Yeah. So again, for most people, it's probably not beneficial. And then especially for athletes, like, no, there's no situation that I can think of where it'd be beneficial.
I want to be clear about this. What would not be beneficial?
Intermittent fasting.
Okay.
Yeah.
Agreed. Yeah. I mean, listen, I think if you're expecting your body to perform, why are you doing intermittent fasting? You need the fuel, right? Now, if you're on a retreat or whatever, like if I'm going to lock myself in a room for, you know, 4 or 5 days and like I'm not expected to perform, then okay, like you can mix that in, or the common person may be able to mix that in. But I think an athlete who's expected to perform and has physical and mental demands on their body, it doesn't make sense. Intermittent fasting. What are the boundaries with that? Sorry, Rob.
No, I was just like, I agree. Like I can't imagine an athlete going to like a 6 a.m. workout and then like going to maybe class and then like a practice at 2 and not have any food throughout that time period is like literally crazy.
Yeah. Yeah.
Literally crazy. I don't know how they would ever do that.
Creating some bad habits too. Cause then, you know, 4 o'clock, 5 o'clock rolls around after practice and you're binging, right?
Exactly. Yeah.
Not to mention college, alcohol, you know, all kinds of different situations.
How and when should an athlete hydrate? And like, how do you know somebody's like dehydrated, or like, how would I know as like an athlete if I need to drink more water or Gatorade or Powerade or, you know, something else? Just touch on like hydration, you know, basic concepts, education for athletes during the game, before the game, in the morning. How do we stay hydrated?
Yeah. So just baseline recommendations, what I like to provide is 1/2 ounce to 1 ounce per pound of body weight. So 1/2 ounce to 1 ounce of fluids per pound of body weight.
So how roughly, say 200, how many cups of water is that? 8 ounces of water.
I'm not good at mental math.
Mental math.
I will put in the show notes, I think.
It's a lot, though, right? I'm just saying it's a lot.
It's a lot. What I normally recommend.
That's a lot. That's a lot.
This is how I do it, so I don't have to do the mental math. All right, let's go 1/2 ounce to 1 ounce per pound of body weight, right? So have an athlete calculate that and then say, let's pull out your water bottle. How many ounces is that? And then just divide it.
Yeah.
That's the way to get off the hook from having to do some mental math. You make them do
so it. So if you weigh 200 pounds and you have a basic Deer Park water bottle or whatever else, whoever's going to pay us.
16.9 fluid ounces.
That's it. Divided by 200 divided by 16.9. And this is for one. I need 11.8. So 12 of those water bottles need to go down the
12
chute.
Water bottles.
So you can do through.
That's for one.
Through
that's
water. One. Yeah, through water, but any fluid that you consume throughout the day. So if you have a smoothie, if you have soup, if you have high water content, like foods like tomatoes, like obviously you can't calculate how many ounces you're getting from it, but all of those things do count. So, you know, I wouldn't say it's easy, but it's easier than people think once you start calculating all of those things in.
And that recommendation is for an athlete.
I would say for an athlete, for general population, I would say probably 1/2 ounce.
A little bit less.
Yeah, okay. 1/2 ounce to, yeah.
Well, I mean, yeah, that's, would you say most athletes are not hydrated?
Oh, absolutely not. Yeah, there's some who are drinking like 40 ounces of water per day. And it's like, I would shrivel up. I don't know why I'm so sensitive, but like I get a headache if I don't drink for like 10 minutes.
And would that impact, how would that impact performance? I've seen it impact weight gain.
Yeah.
An underhydrated athlete is not going to gain weight.
Yeah.
Right.
No, you're right. And we're going to have a lot more weight fluctuations if you're underhydrated. But just like a 2% decrease in body weight from dehydration can have negative impacts on performance. So like motor control, cognitive function, decision making, that type of thing. Just like lethargy, like, right, you've like experienced when you're like feeling tired and then you drink some water, you're like, oh, I'm good to go. So just all of those things, it really has a huge impact. And there's like a ton of research suggesting that most individuals go into an exercise or training session dehydrated. Mm-hmm. So like you can have such a better workout session for general population or training session for athletes if you actually just go in a little bit more hydrated.
Right. And then like during the game, are you recommended Powerade or Gatorade or something else or water? Like what do you usually recommend like during performance for like a field or team-based athlete?
Yeah. So again, depends on the individual. I always just start with the recommendation of water. Once exercise is exceeding 60 minutes, we're going to be burning through most of our carbohydrate stores. That's a good time to start adding in regular Gatorade or Powerade, not G0, not zero calorie stuff, regular Gatorade and Powerade. We want the carbohydrates there. But for most people, if you're just exercising for like 30 to 60 minutes, it's like moderate intensity. You're not sweating a ton. Just stick with water. That's fine.
How do stimulants like caffeine, amphetamines, how do they impact hydration?
So they can cause dehydration potentially, but that would you'd have to drink like a lot of tea, a lot of caffeine and stuff like that. And I don't, correct me if I'm wrong, I don't really think it's from the caffeine, it's from the actual beverage itself. So like coffee is what causes that dehydration if you drink a lot of it.
Okay.
So it's still technically, and you know, you'll have people who argue against this. If you're drinking coffee, you're drinking water. So it still is hydrating to a degree, but once you start to drink a ton of it, then it has that diuretic effect and then it starts to become dehydrating. So yeah.
Beer. Alcohol.
Terrible.
Right. But same thing. Does that dehydrate you to an extent?
Yes, it definitely will.
Okay.
Yeah.
And I think it's important for all of our listeners to really understand what hydrates you, what dehydrates you, right?
Yeah.
Just because it's a fluid doesn't mean it's necessarily hydrating you.
Right.
And how can Rob and I measure how hydrated we are, right? Are we adequately hydrated?
Yeah. So a couple of different ways you can do it. So we say that thirst is the first sign of dehydration. Yes, for some. Like, I think for myself, that is a good sign of dehydration. But if somebody has been ignoring certain signals for a long period of time, they become less noticeable. So like, I always give this example. Same thing with hunger fullness cues too. If you have a fire alarm going off, at first it's going to be so annoying, but if it just goes off all day long, at some point you're going to start to tune it out. So it's the same thing with like hunger fullness regulation and then like thirst regulation as well. So I don't like to just use that as the example, but that's a good way to get started. Other ways you can assess hydration status is looking at urine color. So like, everybody has seen this at their doctors. If you're going to the bathroom and it looks like apple juice, something's wrong. You need to get hydrated. And then on the other side of that, if you're going to the bathroom and it's completely clear, that's a really good indication that you're not retaining electrolytes. So that's when we should be maybe supplementing with electrolytes, or maybe we're overhydrated at that point. And then the last way that I like to suggest and would use this, you know, just for some people who are sweating a ton, athletes who are really working on weight gain, weight change, stuff like that, is weighing in and out from practices. So if you go into a practice at 145 and you get out of practice and then you're now 143, you've lost 2 pounds. For every pound that you lose during exercise, you should be replacing with like 16 to 24 ounces of fluids on top of those baseline hydration needs. So like, yeah, a lot of athletes are walking around dehydrated.
So many athletes are dehydrated.
Yeah.
That's unbelievable.
Yeah.
Right, so you kind of nailed this for me. Like, I don't listen to the alarms. So what I've done, and I'm doing this like more lately, is I'll ask myself like, could I drink some water right now? Like, could I actually do it? And if the answer is yes, like, I'm going to go fill up my water bottle and consume it. But like, I'm running around nonstop sometimes, and like 4 hours goes by and I'm like, oh my God, I've not drank any water. And so like, I will like stand in the back, like, so no one bothers me. And I'll just like, I'll consume a larger amount of water in a shorter period of time, which I know isn't healthy, but I'm trying to get those alarms, you know.
Maybe you can get one of those backpacks, like the hiking backpacks that has the straw. Just drink all throughout the day.
Good, like one of our aides to just carry around a little straw from like Happy Gilmore or something. Now, this is great. Supplements, like a quick touch on this. Let's go to protein first. How would you typically recommend for an athlete to identify a protein that is appropriate for them, or a protein powder, supplement, or even if it's a shake?
So talking just about convenience, if you're somebody who like doesn't like protein powder, or you just like want something that's like on the go, you don't want to have to worry about washing a blender bottle, stuff like that, the ready to drink protein options can be really good. So like a Core Power, a Muscle Milk, or Gain, things like that could be really good. They're usually more expensive than protein powders, so I usually push people in the direction of protein powders first. Always recommend something that is third party tested. So before we get into the rest of supplements, this is super important to go over. Almost all the supplement industry is unregulated. So like, the food that we eat is either regulated by the FDA, the USDA, or some other type of government agency. The supplement industry is not regulated in that way. The only time a government agency steps in to regulate is if there are severe adverse health side effects reported, heart attack, stroke, death, all of those things, right? Then the government steps in and is like, probably not good to have on the shelf. But you can get third-party testing through some credible agencies in sports performance, what we look at, or sports nutrition, what we look at is Informed Sport or Informed Choice, and then NSF Certified by Sport. Those are the two most credible. So I only recommend products that have those two certifications.
I mean, that's the only thing you can actually stand by, right? Because we don't actually know what's in it. I mean, we shouldn't necessarily assume they're lying, but we shouldn't assume they're telling the truth either. It's not FDA regulated.
Yeah. It's way cheaper to put in just fillers into supplements than to actually get like a high quality product. So if it's not regulated by those, I would be pretty sure that it has a high chance of contamination. Study came out a couple of years ago saying that I think it was like up to 30% of supplements are contaminated if they don't have those third party testing seals.
Wow, so that's
like
30%.
Yeah. That's a really high percentage.
I think this is really important, especially for our athletes, student athletes out there that get drug tested. I know we dealt with this. We had an athlete that tested positive for an amphetamine, claimed that it was like in a pre-workout. And so I immediately took my pre-workout to our athletic trainer and I was like, hey, is this like, am I good with this? He's like, not FDA regulated, dude. I don't know. I'm like, wait, you told me if I brought something up to you, you would be able to tell me. He goes, yeah, if it's third party, you know, if it's checked out by, so, you know, a third party. So He said, there is a ton of caffeine in this and you can test positive for caffeine. And I was like, hold on, what? Really? Like, and I had no idea. And yeah. I was like a junior at the time. So it's not like I was new to this.
Yeah.
So I really think it's important for our student athletes to understand, like, what are they being tested for? And is it legitimate? Should they be taking it? And I think that's, you know, someone, you know, contact you in your private consultation business, or if you have one at school, that'd be great too.
Yes. So,
you know, use your resources for that.
Definitely. And one thing that I want to add is I did a little experiment. I went to GNC one time and I asked if they had any pre-workouts that were certified by Informed Sport. And they said, oh, we don't carry that brand. So they just had no clue what that is. And so these like people who work in GNC and all of these stores, they have some nutrition knowledge for sure, but they don't really know. So if you're like a college athlete or you have the potential of getting drug tested, I mean, really anyone, just to make sure you're putting the right,
sure,
the safe things in your body, like do your research before you go in. Yeah.
I mean, Ken, definitely high school. I don't know about college, probably college. That's where they go to get their supplements.
Absolutely. Yeah.
You know, and yeah, I think most of them are looking at what their big friend is taking in the gym and they're, oh, you're taking a pre-workout? Like that must be good for me too. And go and look at these pre-workouts and one, they're not regulated. And two, it's just like, what the heck's in these things? And,
yeah.
You know, the amount of caffeine that's in these pre-workouts.
Some of the side effects.
Is insane. We're talking like 280 and like 300 milligrams caffeine.
Yeah. Which is excessive. That is like, you don't need that much in a pre-workout. And if you really feel like you need that much of an energy boost, you're probably not eating enough or sleeping enough.
Well said. Creatine. I feel like I'm just going back to, I'm hitting some of the major ones. Yeah. Like creatine, monohydrate, like how young is too young to take creatine? Maybe we start with that.
Great question. So anytime we're looking at creatine or anytime we talk about it now, let's assume that it's creatine monohydrate. It's the most researched supplement and it is very safe. So your body actually naturally produces it and you get it through some animal protein products. So you're already getting it. I don't like to recommend creatine to athletes under 18 unless they have been working with me for a period of time and their nutrition looks really good. So if we are 16 years old and we're not doing really great with our nutrition, our energy expenditure is 3,500 a day and we're only consuming 2,200. And we start to add creatine in, well, like we're going to actually have a way better effect. If we add more calories in, you're going to get way stronger. You're going to feel way more recovered, all of those things versus just focusing on creatine. So it's like, just like, it's not important to focus on if we're not doing a good job with nutrition already. But let's say that they are doing a great job. I love recommending creatine because it's going to be so, so helpful for so many different things. It's necessary for high intensity energy bouts. So like if you're thinking about a sprint, when you're lifting, when you're throwing, when you're hitting all of those things, your body is using that first, even before we use carbohydrates. Your body only has naturally about 40 to 60% muscle saturation. So if we can supplement and get up to 100% muscle saturation, we can just supply way more high intensity exercise with it. Why wouldn't we want to do that? But again, that's something that we add in after we've already done a really good job with our intake.
You need the foundation there. Hey, make sure you drink a lot more water than you normally will with creatine. Is that true? Is that like, do you have any recommendations?
Yeah, I mean, I would just make sure you're properly hydrated. So if you're already doing a bad job with hydration, like let's add more. Creatine's going to pull water into the muscle cells. So you just have like less for other bodily functions. It doesn't just like make you shrivel up or it's not going to like cause kidney damage or stuff like that. We want to make sure that we are properly hydrated.
I get that all the time.
Yeah.
It's like, wait, doesn't creatine just make you look like, isn't it just water weight?
Yeah.
Well, no.
And I'm going to take creatine to gain weight. It's like, no, we're not. That's not what we're doing.
We're seeing this a lot now. Like I remember the days of like pro hormone type supplements, right? What was it, like Ray Lewis's locker? It's like the velvet from a deer antler or something like that.
Yeah.
Maybe it's legitimate stuff. I don't know. What are your thoughts on some of these supplements that are pro hormone? Are you like, absolutely no. Like maybe it depends on the situation. What are your thoughts on some of that?
So I don't really delve into that really at all because of the population I'm working with. And then also again, like I know I've said this a bunch of times, but like those people who are taking those things, there's very few people who are doing everything they can with the nutrition and recovery and sleep and exercise. Like they're not checking the boxes already. So to add in those other things is kind of pointless. And anybody who would actually need like additional benefit and they're already doing a good job with nutrition are probably getting drug tested. You know what I mean? So I really don't get into a lot of those things. We can do a really good job if we really time nutrition properly, we're really sleeping well, we're exercising and recovering well, things like that.
I love it. Build the foundation first.
Yeah. I wish supplements I could like have way more fun with them. Like you, when you're an undergrad, you read like all this research on these like cool things and you're like, wow, this is amazing. And then you realize that they're not credible. There's one study done on it. And like, you know, it's just, it's not even worth going near.
I mean, the only other, I think, supplement question that I have is when it comes to protein, there's the whey protein and then there's casein protein. Mm-hmm. Is casein protein something that you would recommend for athletes? Yes, no.
So whey and casein are derivatives of milk. So when you break milk down, you get two different types of protein, whey and casein. Whey is a fast digesting protein and casein is much slower digesting. So how they have been used in the past is whey is something that you take like post-workout or throughout the day. And then casein is something that you can take before bed. So it's going to have that really slow rate of breakdown and can help with like a muscle repair overnight or weight gain. I actually don't think that casein is necessary to kind of get into because it's expensive. It tastes really bad. It feels really heavy in your stomach. And we can basically get the same benefits with whey and like adding in some other slower digesting things with it, like peanut butter or whole milk or stuff like that. So casein isn't bad. I just don't really personally recommend it. I kind of think it's like a waste of money when you can be looking at some other things.
All right. So we got a fast five here. So we're going to run through five quick questions. All right. And if you got any, Rob, you can jump on. I have like three for sure, but I can come up with two other quick ones. All right. You got one. All right. I'll save you for number five. I'll take the first four. Right. So first one is, what is the perfect pregame meal and what time are you eating it for prior to competition?
Okay, so perfect pregame meal, you're going to eat it 3 to 4 hours before, and it's going to be, let's keep it basic, grilled chicken with rice and some type of vegetable and a piece of fruit on the side and maybe some chocolate milk. We're going to do minimal sauce on there.
I'd love it. Okay, I'll go with that. Next one, what is a diet you would recommend for someone who has an injury, anything specific?
Focus on anti-inflammatory food. So berries, leafy greens, avocados, chia seed, flaxseed, olive oil, really kind of dismiss some fried foods that are pro-inflammatory.
Okay. How late is too late to eat dinner?
Depends on the individual. If you're an athlete that gets back really late from training and you haven't had dinner, I want you to eat dinner before you go to bed versus just saying, well, it's 8 o'clock, so I can't eat now.
Okay. Male versus female, they weigh the same. They're both cross-country athletes. How do their caloric intake, how should that be different?
Oh, it depends on age. It depends on a lot of factors.
College athlete.
You got to dive into that one a little bit more. That's a tough one to answer. I'm sorry.
That's fair. I was just curious in terms of like a male body versus a female body, muscle mass, like if the weight is the same, right?
Yeah.
How does that change?
But it really depends because, well, the female athlete's probably going to have higher percentage body fat just right. Because that's what's essential for females. So with having more muscle mass, your energy expenditure is going to be higher. So males would probably have a higher energy expenditure in most cases, but there definitely could be other cases where females might be higher.
Sure. Like a gymnast, you know, yeah, that makes perfect sense. They're going to have more muscle mass.
Gymnast or somebody recovering from an eating disorder. Yeah.
Okay. There you go. You got number five is yours.
Yeah. I actually have two. I'm going to go six. Number five, how much better is organic food than a regular, like organic bananas or regular bananas? Are they the same? Is one better than the other?
Okay. For almost all cases, just get the regular food. If you're somebody who has a lot of financial means and you want to get organic, that's definitely not going to hurt you either. But there's not enough information to say that eating non-organic food is harmful to your health.
Okay. And number six, what are your thoughts on energy drinks?
Stop looking at me.
Because I know a lot of people that have energy drinks. Are there some that are better than others? Some that you do not recommend?
Okay. So the only one that's actually third party tested is Red Bull. So that's the only one. If athletes really love energy drinks, that's the only one that I'm like, all right, fine. But also modify your intake. Most of them are containing banned substances or are not regulated and just have stuff in there that actually can cause you to go into cardiac arrest. And it's happened. People are drinking energy drinks like Celsius, Alani Nu, Reign, all these crazy ones, all these like trendy ones. They look really pretty, the bottle, but they're really not regulated really well. And if you have your venti coffee from Starbucks and then you have an energy drink a couple hours later, like that is very, very harmful.
So. I mean, especially if you're, you know, someone with AFib or any kind of pre-existing cardiac condition, right? I mean, I think, that sounds like a problem.
And especially for teenagers who might not know that they have a pre-existing heart condition, when they're mixing all these things, really, really bad idea.
Or with alcohol.
Yep. Bad idea.
Four Locos in college. Remember that? I never had one, but I'd heard of them. That's everything I got. Do you guys got anything else? Anything else you want to dive into?
No, I think we covered a lot. I think like main theme, just takeaway, is really look at your intake before we start adding in all these crazy things. Or if you feel like you're overcomplicating nutrition, if you feel like you have all these questions, you are overcomplicating it. Keep it simple. Bring it back to the basics. Are you eating breakfast? Are you eating three meals a day? Are you eating about every 3 to 4 hours? If you answer no to any of those and you have some work to do.
Keep it simple, stupid.
Yep. There you go.
Love it. So, you know, add the cherry on top. And if you aren't sure, reach out to a registered dietitian. And don't call them a nutritionist. So speaking of which, how do our listeners get in contact with you?
Yes. So I have my Instagram. It's @hammer_fuel. Try to post as much as possible, but sometimes we're
post more content.
Yeah. I know. I'm sorry.
Come on, you're not busy. Post it.
I also have my website, which is hammerfuelnutrition.com. And then email is always probably the easiest form of communication.
Your business, is it virtual? Is it in person? Both?
Everything is virtual. So I try to accommodate as many people as possible, as many busy athletes as possible. So everything we do is virtual.
Check out that information on the contact page. And that's a wrap.
Thanks for listening to the On Cue Performance Therapy Podcast. If you'd like this episode, please subscribe on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. It would mean so much to me if you could leave us a 5-star review so more listeners like you could get this important information. See you next time.